Trump has strong words for Nicolas Maduro, but is the U.S. ready to take big action? Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The president spoke at FIU Monday, telling supporters he's ready to do whatever necessary to get Maduro out of power in Venezuela.
We seek a peaceful transition of power, but all options are open.
How far is the U.S. willing to go in Venezuela? Also, we'll get a look inside the Homestead Detention Center, the largest of its kind in the U.S. There's an effort to shut it down. The organization running the center claims it's providing the children all they need. Critics say it needs to be closed. And today we have our Sundial Book Club conversation with Arlo Haskell on the February title, The Jews of Key West. And the old Jewish tradition of mikvah is the focus of a play in Boca Raton tomorrow. We'll talk with the director who wanted to bring this story out with its connection to the Me Too movement. All of that today on Sundial. First, the news. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thanks so much for joining us. President Trump was at Florida International University Monday discussing the ongoing crisis in Venezuela and the U.S. response.
Millions of Venezuelans are starving and suffering while a small handful at the top of the Maduro regime plunder the nation into poverty and into death. We know who they are, and we know where they keep the billions of dollars that they have stolen.
USAID has been blocked at the Colombian border into Venezuela. Interim president and head of the Venezuelan Congress, Juan Guaido, has set a deadline for the blockade to end by Saturday. WLRN Latin American correspondent Tim Padgett was following the president's speech, getting reaction from the Venezuelan community here in South Florida, and he joins us now in studio. Always great to have you, Tim.
Thank you, Luis.
All right, so first of all, let's just start with this. Where did things stand in Venezuela with attempts to push out Nicolas Maduro and U.S. efforts to get humanitarian aid into the country?
Well, things are very much in limbo now since that exhilaration we all felt a few weeks ago when the U.S. and much of the international community decided to recognize Guaido as the legitimate president in Venezuela and to renounce Nicolas Maduro, the socialist leader there. So things are very much in limbo, a limbo that could be broken, obviously, this weekend when we're supposed to see efforts on the part of this U.S.-led effort to push these hundreds of tons of humanitarian aid, food, medicine, other basic necessities into Venezuela from places like border spots like Cucuta, Colombia. How they're going to do it, we really don't know, but they say they are.
Because they don't have the military there. They're just saying, we want it to end because we want to get this stuff in. We just don't know.
Well, it's an optic thing. I mean, what they really want to do is challenge the Venezuelan military. Are you really going to stand there on the border and keep hundreds of tons of desperately needed humanitarian aid coming into your country? Do you really want the world to see the Venezuelan military looking like it's essentially committing what Senator Marco Rubio called this week would be a crime against humanity? So it's an optic thing more than anything else.
And of course, the president yesterday suggesting, as other people have, that all options are on the table, which of course means there is a military option.
Military intervention. They've always said from the beginning of this that option is still on the table. Would they ever take it? Boy, it's doubtful. That would really be the most drastic resort, really, that they could take. But a lot of people are thinking, though, after what we've done so far, what else is there left?
And I was thinking about it. I was having this conversation, with some folks in the newsroom. When's the last time the U.S. military got involved in foreign policy in Latin America? And I was thinking, what was it, Panama?
Panama, that would have been, okay. Well, overtly like that, yes.
Right, right.
A full-blown invasion, yeah, 1989, December 1989, the Panama invasion.
And is there an appetite for that right now, really?
No. In the 21st century, no. There's just simply too much of historical memory of U.S. intervention, whether it be it overt or covert, military or otherwise, in Latin America. I mean, this goes all the way back to the early 1800s when, the Mexican-American War and incidents like that just really have not put the United States in a very positive light in Latin America for centuries.
So this comes down to sanctions. So are the sanctions in place working? Is that what we're counting?
Well, they may very well be working. The problem is sanctions take a while to work. And one of the problems here is that the Trump administration may have raised expectations so high for a speedy resolution of this crisis, a speedy overthrow of the socialist Maduro regime in Venezuela, that people could be soon becoming very impatient, when in reality, these kinds of sanctions take time to work.
Talking again with WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Yesterday, President Trump speaking at Florida International University about the ongoing crisis in Venezuela and the possible U.S. response and what that should be. Find us on Twitter, WLRN Sundial. We'd like to hear your thoughts. How far should the U.S. go in removing Nicolas Maduro in power in Venezuela? All right, so you had the opportunity, Tim, to talk with a number of Venezuela expats at yesterday's event. What's their response to Trump's language right now? I mean, again, you're saying this is going to take time, but I'm taking from what you just said that they're thinking, no, this is moving fast. We're going to get this done.
Well, some are, some aren't. Some do take the attitude that, okay, we know this is going to take a long time. But what's different is we finally got the United States and the international community, including a lot of neighboring Latin American countries for the first time ever, on our side. So we've got that momentum. What many Venezuelans don't want to see is that military intervention, because that could just create a lot more problems for them and the opposition in Venezuela than it would solve. You do have people here and in Venezuela who do think that a military solution on the part of the U.S. would really be the only thing that's left to try to oust this disastrous Maduro regime. So things are split. But you see Venezuelans definitely divided on that issue, a lot more divided than they would be, say, you know, than we would find the Cuban exile community here to be on the issue of Cuba, for example.
Yeah, we look at, I mean, you got Venezuela, and you also have the issue with Daniel Ortega, Nicaragua. Your LATAM report today focuses on the crisis in Nicaragua. Is there a shift happening in Latin America in these countries? Or again, is it just there's just a lot more attention to what's happening because the crisis is so much worse?
I think there is a shift happening because you're seeing these leftist regimes, not just, you know, Cuba and Venezuela, but also Nicaragua, Bolivia, for example, is another one. You've seen these regimes start to panic and become quite brutal in terms of trying to put down dissent in their countries as the problems keep mounting. Nicaragua is a very disturbing example, as the stories in our Latin America report today tell us about how brutal the Daniel Ortega regime has become in order to preserve, you know, its power there, and it's just become a rather ruthless dictatorship.
Is there a tipping point in these countries like Nicaragua, Venezuela?
Venezuela, the tipping point has to be the military. When does the military decide that it is no longer going to be loyal to Nicolas Maduro? Because the military is the only thing keeping Nicolas Maduro in power right now.
And President Trump yesterday basically giving them an out,
exactly,
saying, go on, come on our side,
right,
we'll give you...
That's the big diplomatic effort right now, is to convince the military command in Venezuela to turn its back on Maduro. But frankly, most of us who've been watching Venezuela for this long realize that that tipping point that you're talking about is going to be when the money runs out. And that's what's going to take some time with these sanctions, particularly the oil sanctions we've slapped on Venezuela. When the money runs out for the military, then maybe we'll see them turn their back on Maduro.
WLRN's Latin America correspondent Tim Padgett. Check out his LATAM report coming up this afternoon on All Things Considered. Tim, always a pleasure.
Thank you, Lewis.
All right, still to come, the Homestead Detention Center houses thousands of migrant children who cross the border into the United States. We get the latest on the controversial site as lawmakers visit today. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus are at the Homestead Detention Facility right now. They're touring the operations and holding a roundtable discussion with immigrant advocates. The facility is the only for-profit childhood detention center in the country and the largest, with over 2,000 child migrants currently in custody. Now, the center has come under sharp scrutiny for its treatment of minors, and there's been a push by numerous Democratic lawmakers and nonprofit organizations to shut it down. The Office of Refugee Resettlement, which oversees the network of temporary influx shelters for migrants, has defended the detention center and argues that it's a much better alternative to the holding cells at the border. NPR Southwest correspondent John Burnett took a tour of the facility recently, and you can hear his story for NPR on our social media, WLRN Sundell. He joins us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. John, such a pleasure. Thanks so much.
Hey, Luis. Glad to be here.
You got to tour the facility here in Homestead. How would you describe it to someone?
Well, I was there about 2 weeks ago, and they gave me a tour. You know, it's down there, you know, south of Miami in a former Department of Labor Job Corps center right next to Homestead Air Reserve Base. It's huge. It's 50 acres, and it's not near as bad as the Tornillo tent camp that was out here in West Texas, where you had these big tan tents out like a moonscape, you know, down on the border. But, you know, it's blinkered. You see what they want you to see. I've been on three of these tours now, and ostensibly, you know, it looks like a summer camp, but it's not.
And that's what that's the image that they want you to have, is that everything looks good. Real quickly, how are these children arriving at Homestead? Where are they coming from?
Well, a lot of them are coming straight from the border, from Customs and Border Protection custody. The law says that children who arrive at the border alone or without their parents or a guardian, they call them unaccompanied alien children, that they can only spend 72 hours in these very Spartan, very unpleasant Border Patrol holding cells. And after 3 days, they need to be transferred to a facility that's more sensitive to children. And that's where this temporary influx center comes in. Homestead has been set up to receive children from the border to stay there at Homestead until they can find them sponsors.
What kind of access did you get, John? I mean, who did you get to talk to, and what parts of it did they keep you out of?
Well, I mean, I probably got the same access that the members of Congress are getting today, and that is the program director takes you around in a golf cart, and you see these lines of children, you know, 12 at a time, most of them Central American teenagers from Guatemala, El Salvador, Honduras, and some from Nicaragua. You know, they're going here and there. They've got a youth care worker with them who is monitoring them, their every move. They even have to, you know, request permission to go to the bathroom. And so you see the kids, and then you see the counselors, everyone smiling, and you see the classrooms, and you see the soccer stadium, and you see the Xbox games, and you know, it's fine, and
but you
know, it's a lot better than it was in the Border Patrol holding facility. But you know, it's not a happy place for the kids, and that's just the reality.
You were able to talk with the attorneys that represent some of the children. Let's hear real quickly from Leisha Welch, Senior Director of Legal Advocacy and Child Welfare at the National Center for Youth Law.
We hear stories of children who are told from the first day of their orientation at the facility that under no circumstances can they touch another child in the facility, even their own sibling, even friends who they're saying goodbye to after many months of shared intense experience. They can't hug them goodbye. If they do, they're told they will be written up and it could affect their immigration case. We see a very different picture than the reporters see.
John, you were recently able to speak with a young Salvadoran woman who spent 2 months at the facility. Is her story similar to what Welch was talking about there?
You know, it is, Luis. And the frustrating thing about taking a tour of the facility is that you never get to talk to the children. And they say, well, they're kids. They can't talk to you. It's privacy. You know, it's out of the question. And I had the opportunity not only to talk to attorneys like Leisha, who have been appointed by a federal court actually to monitor the care of these children who are in federal custody. So they had interviewed 24 of the kids when I talked to them. And as it happens, I had the good fortune to speak to an 18-year-old whose name is Liseth, thank you. And she confirmed exactly what the attorney said. I didn't ask any leading questions at all. She said, I said, you know, is this a albergue para niños, a child shelter, or un centro de detención, a center of detention? She said, it's a detention center. She said, we're not free to go anywhere. We can't touch other, we can't talk to the boys, we can't touch each other. When I finally was able to leave, I couldn't hug anybody. The youth care workers can't, you know, really talk to us kindly. She was, you know, she really had some harsh things to say about it. And in fairness to the government that contracts these places, then she went to Boys Town, which is another federally contracted youth shelter there in the Miami area. And she said it was much more humane, that it was just a more family kind of a place, and they, it wasn't as strict, and they, it wasn't as inhuman and dehumanizing as she said that Homestead was.
This is the, as I mentioned at the beginning, it was, is the largest childhood migration or migrant detention facility in the country. What's the justification for a facility of that magnitude?
Well, the Office of Refugee Resettlement, which pays for these things and pays an enormous sum every day to these places, says that it has to have a sort of an intake center that's flexible, so that, you know, all these children who are coming to the border, 5,000 of these unaccompanied kids came to the border in January alone, and we're talking a substantial number. They have to be able to sort of ramp up and ramp down, and so that's why you need these flexible centers. But they come with problems, and as you all know, they're not licensed by your state Department of Family and Children, and that has, you know, another set of issues. And then they're huge. There was, you know, almost 1,600 children there. They're contracted to go up to 2,350 kids. I mean, that's, you know, that's bigger than a lot of towns in Florida. And, you know, so these are not kind places for, you know, children who've gone through traumatic journeys to be.
And as we pointed out, too, this is a for-profit institution. What's the cost of running this place?
The latest figure is about $1.1 million a day, it works out to. Comprehensive Health Services, the contractor, which is based in Cape Canaveral, has a contract that goes up to $220 million. They're breathtakingly expensive because they have 2,300 employees at Homestead. It's very labor intensive. They have, you know, one youth care worker for every 12 kids. They've got to have mental health workers, you know, medical care. They've got to have, you know, their own fire department. I mean, the standards really are quite high. But having said that, you know, that's a chunk of change. And so, you know, the for-profits are in the game now.
I'm talking with NPR correspondent John Burnett. He recently visited the Homestead Detention Center, which houses almost a couple thousand child migrants coming across the border, primarily from Central America. The facility is the largest childhood detention center in the country, and as we just mentioned, it's for profit. And he's joining us from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. John, there are a number of efforts to shut down the Homestead Detention Center. And this, again, after the one in Texas was closed. But real quickly, how did the Trujillo camp in West Texas get closed? What happened there?
Well, what happened is the operator out there, which is BCFS, which is a well-known kind of emergency services provider in Texas and all over the country, had just had a bellyful of this contract. And it was difficult, exhausting. Their own staff out there were having morale problems. The kids were just coming and coming and coming, and there was a great frustration that the federal government was not doing all that it could to try to find sponsors for these children and get them out of the camps and get them into a loving household. And so the operator, BCFS, said, look, Washington, we want out of our contract. You know, we don't want to do this indefinitely. And so they were able to get out of it. And to the government's credit, they were able to place thousands of these children with families in a matter of days. So when they have to move fast, they can move fast and discharge these children and find families for them. So that really was a unique situation, you know, having to do with the contractor and the government. Now you have You actually have federal legislation that wants to shut down Homestead.
Yeah, I mean, you have people like Miami Congresswoman Debbie Mercosaw Powell touring the facility today. That legislation you're talking about, brought up by House Democrats, called the Shut Down Child Prisons Camp Act. What does that legislation entail, and what do they plan on doing with those kids?
Well, the bill that I read said basically it would forbid Health and Human Services to have these temporary influx shelters that are unlicensed by the state. That, you know, there are about 130 of these child shelters around the country. This is the only temporary influx, which is giant, and which is unlicensed. And so this is the one that they want to shut down.
And the folks, as you mentioned, the folks that run the organization that runs the Homestead Detention Center, Comprehensive Health Services, did you get to talk to anybody from there? I wonder what they're saying.
Well, they don't talk, you know. And if you talk to the private prison companies, you know, CoreCivic and Geo Group, they won't talk either. They're all publicly traded, and they figured, you know, the less written about them, the better. Comprehensive Health Services, actually, it's not, Homestead is not the only for-profit facility now. As I reported in my story, CHS has just been licensed by the state of Texas to run three permanent child shelters in Texas, in South Texas, for these unaccompanied kids. So they're moving into this in a big way. And I should say, I looked at their record, and there have been inspections since they took over these, and they have gone very, very well. They've gotten very few violations.
Yeah, well, hold on.
These three facilities in Texas.
You said permanent?
Yeah, well, the difference is Homestead is a temporary facility. These are called permanent facilities just because they have to abide by state licenses.
Now, one of the other things, too, is that the kids can age out of these facilities. So, I mean, once they hit 18, right? And then they have to leave.
And this is really one of the more wrenching chapters in this. And I've got a story coming out hopefully on Friday about this. All over the country, when you have these older teenagers, the 17-year-olds, at these youth shelters run by the government, when they turn 18, sometimes at midnight when they turn 18, immigration agents show up, handcuff them, put them in vans, and drive them to adult detention centers. Yours is called the Broward Transitional Center in Miami, and that's where the kids who age out at Homestead and the other places go. And it's really traumatic. I mean, imagine you've been in this, for all of its problems, it is still a shelter that's geared to children. And so, you know, it's three warm meals a day, it's two snacks, you get to play soccer, you know, they have games, and they're at least acknowledging your youth. And then on your 18th birthday, happy birthday, you know, we're now handcuffing you, wrists, ankles, to your waist, and we're going to put you in with a bunch of adult detainees until you can be released to a sponsor. And so there's a bunch of lawsuits about this, and that's what I'm writing about.
That's a story that you've got that you're working on. Looking forward to hearing that one. There is an interesting coalition of folks coming out in opposition to this facility, including Miami-Dade Superintendent Alberto Carvalho. He spoke about his concerns with this center on the South Florida Roundup here on WLRN last summer.
And let's not forget that besides this unacceptable warehousing of children, regardless of condition, these are children who are experiencing stress, trauma, horror via their forced separation from their parents. So to the extent that the condition is normalized, these kids are returned to their parents, it's the very least that the most powerful nation on earth can do for them.
So what is Carvalho's personal connection to this story?
It's really interesting, Luisa, and I didn't know this until I met him for an interview down at the school headquarters, but you know, he is from Portugal, and at age 17 he came to New York City as an unaccompanied youth. He came on a visa, and then he overstayed it, and he worked in a restaurant, and eventually you know, ended up in Miami. I don't know the complete story, and you know, now is head of the nation's fourth largest school system. quite a success story, but he feels very personally the journeys of these kids, and that there's, you know, he's pissed off that there are two other permanent child detention facilities in Miami that he has certified school teachers in. He has Miami-Dade County certified teachers teaching the kids, and they have investigated the educational services, and if there are kids with special needs, they're taking care of that. And he can put people in those shelters, but he can't put his people in Homestead. They won't let him in there because it's on federal property. It's the King's X because it's not licensed. And so do he's not at all happy about that.
Yeah. Does that mean, do we know anything about, you know, are these kids getting any kind of education?
Yes, they are. They absolutely are. And in fairness to Homestead, they're getting, I think, 6 hours of education a day. And some of the teachers are certified, but not all of them are. Fewer than half of the teachers there are certified. And, you know, I saw the classrooms and they were full of kids and the teacher was animated and, you know, they were learning English and education was going on. But it's not certified by the school district, and he's not happy about that.
John Burnett is an NPR correspondent talking about the Homestead Detention Center. He was there recently and getting a chance to look around and see how they are running that facility. Again, almost a couple thousand migrant kids staying there now. It is the largest of its kind in the country, a for-profit. And again, we have lawmakers who are there today getting a tour. There is an effort to try to shut the place down. He's joining us again from the studios of KUT in Austin, Texas. John, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you for the insight, and looking forward to the other reporting you're doing on what happens when these kids turn 18. That is a sad story.
Thank you, Luis. I really appreciate you asking me on the show.
All right. Still to come, we have our monthly author conversation for the Sundial Book Club. We're going to talk with Arlo Haskell about the story of the Jewish people in their role in Key West history. That's all coming up next here on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. If you want to understand what makes Key West what it is, you have to look into its history and the influence of the Jewish community. Going back almost 200 years, Jews have shaped the island city time and time again. They helped rebuild the island after a massive fire in the 1880s and then after three powerful hurricanes in the early part of the 20th century. They also played an important role during the Cuban Revolution. All of these stories are part of the book, The Jews of Key West, Smugglers, Cigar Makers, and Revolutionaries by Arlo Haskell. This is the February book for the Sundial Book Club. You can find out more on our Facebook page. It's free to join. We welcome everybody. And joining us now from the Southernmost Bureau, the studios of Key West, Mr. Haskell. It's such a pleasure.
Hey, it's a pleasure to be on the air with you, Lewis. Thanks for having me.
Let me just start with this. How did you get the chance to write this book? Where did the inspiration, the idea come from?
Well, the book sort of came to me about 8 years ago. I sat down for lunch with a woman named Susie Savage, who had gathered oral histories and family documents from a number of local Jewish families. She had thought that she would write a history of the Jewish community here at one point, and then had decided it was a project that you know, she wanted to find somebody else for. So it all started there with that lunch meeting. As I looked over some of the photographs she had found, and you know, listened to some of the summaries of the stories she had learned, and I thought, you know, wow, there's some really interesting stories here that are different than the Key West I knew, and I wanted, you know, immediately to dive down into this particular vein of Key West history and find a side of Key West that hadn't been written about before.
And before you started working on this book, I mean, yeah, what did you know about the history of the Jewish community in Key West?
I knew bits and pieces. I was friends with David Wolkowski, who passed away this year at age 99, and his grandfather, Abram Wolkowski, came to Key West after the Great Fire of 1886, arrived here as a peddler with, you know, pennies to his name, and within a decade or so, had become quite successful. You know, his son was very successful after him, and then David was sort of the third generation of that. So I was familiar with the family story of David Wolkowski, and I knew this story of, I think, what's kind of a classic immigrant rags-to-riches success story, and a particularly classic Jewish story of the you know, Polish or Russian Jew who arrives as a peddler and works their way up to success. So that was really the extent of what I knew at the time, was through his family story.
There were, I didn't realize this, there were, I mean, you had three really, I think, three major natural events and then three man-made, I guess, moments that really shaped the island. And let's start with the hurricanes. You had the hurricane 1909, 1910, another one in 1919. Mm-hmm. What impact did these storms have on the island? And then really the aftermath, because there was the rebuilding phase, and that's when you started to see different groups of Jewish people coming into the city and helping rebuild it.
Yeah, and I think each of those storms had its own different impact. The 1909, 1910 hurricanes, you know, the devastation was compounded by there being, you know, two of them, roughly a year to the day back to back. You know, everybody in South Florida knows what it's like to get hit hard by one storm. And maybe when that date rolls around on the calendar next year, you remember how bad it was, and you are glad that a year has gone by, except in this case, a year after the 1909 storm came, the 1910 storm came. So it was a real 1-2 punch that, you know, knocked Key West on its heels. And then Key West, you know, was bouncing back to some degree. Another 10 years went by. 1919, when that storm came, it was another kind of a 1-2 punch. You know, World War I had recently ended. The Volstead Act, which put, which made prohibition the law of the land, had just gone into place. Key West had been a big Navy town, so the end of World War I had removed a lot of the population. You know, the Navy money that had been here supporting shops and businesses of all kinds. And then there were a lot of, you know, bar businesses in Key West then as now. So prohibition, you know, made people's livelihoods, you know, illegal at that point in time. And then you had this hurricane of 1919 that came in. So it was the 1919 hurricane was really like the finishing blow for what would have been a very difficult economic period, even without the natural disaster. And as I say in the book, you know, most people think of the 20s as the roaring 20s. And the Depression began in 1929. But in Key West, the Depression really began then in 1919 at the dawn of the 20s. And the decade of the 20s was, you know, hard times here.
And another big event, too, was the Cuban Revolution. And it was important in Key West because revolutionary and poet José Martí spent a lot of time in Key West trying to recruit support, especially from the Jewish community. Why?
Yeah, that's right. And that was one of the most fascinating pieces of the research for me, was the, you know, Cuban revolutionary activities during the 1890s, when Martí was here rallying support for his cause. Key West was really, I think, second to New York in terms of the economic might of the exile base that was here. It was a hugely important exile center for Martí and his, you know, followers that were going to eventually did overthrow the Spanish and secure an independent Cuba. Martí's call was really for equality, was for democracy, was for an egalitarian system and way of life. And he made explicit appeals to Jews in Key West and beyond. And he also spoke to his Cuban followers. He used the idea of, you know, the historic idea of Jews and the culture around Judaism to say, on the one hand, to his fellow Cubans, if we don't fight off the Spanish, we're going to end up as bad as the Jews. We're going to be as persecuted as Jews have been, you know, for centuries since ancient times. So that was, on the one hand, a rallying cry to the Cuban audience that he was speaking to. But he also made it clear that Cuba, a free Cuba, was going to be for anyone. You didn't have to be Cuban by birth. It was for anybody who believed in these ideals of liberty and equality.
And Jews and Cubans actually had a shared enemy, Spain.
Absolutely. You know, Spain, under the Inquisition, of course, you know, Spain had terrorized Jews for centuries. And that was, you know, the Inquisition officially lasted in the Americas until like the 1830s or 1840s or something like that. Somebody, one of your listeners will know this better than I do. But so for some of the Jews who were in Key West in the latter half of the 19th century, the Inquisition was still, you know, part of living memory for the elders of the community. Yeah. So, yeah, it was a way to strike back at Spain. In fact, one of the main Jewish leaders of the Cuban Revolutionary Movement here, Louis Fine, he said that he had participated with Martí, you know, out of a sense of vengeance against Spain.
We're talking with author Arlo Haskell. His book is The Jews of Key West, Smugglers, Cigar Makers, and Revolutionaries, the February title for the Sundial Book Club. You can learn more about it on our Facebook page. Arlo right now is joining us from the studios in Key West. One of our book club members, Delilah Rubio from Miami, posted on Facebook, I'm Cuban, not Jewish, but I'm interested in reading about the Jewish revolutionaries. Also, by the way, if you find us on the Facebook page, I posted a little trivia there for you guys, which was likely the first Jewish-owned bar in Key West. Arlo will answer that question here coming up, but it's also on the Facebook page in case if you think you know it is because you've been reading the book. You know, one of the other interesting things I didn't realize is, I mean, so, you know, Key West was just a great place for Jews to come down, start businesses, raise families, and then, of course, a very good relationship with Cubans for a while. But then after World War II, after World War I, I believe it was, then the U.S. government started to put limitations on immigrants, and they put a lot of limitations on Jews and Chinese immigrants. And then Cuba became a refuge for many of the Jews. Tell us about what that relationship was like around that time and how Jews were still trying to get into the U.S. with these tough immigration laws.
Sure, yeah. So the immigration laws that affected Jews most strongly were passed shortly after that 1919, you know, hurricane that we were talking about. This is part of the hard times era of Key West. You know, the economy is kind of in tatters. There's been storm damage. And then a new president is elected and the immigration acts are passed in 1921 and 1924. And effectively, they just dramatically reduced the number of Jews who were allowed into the United States. I think it reduced the total by about 90%. And it wasn't so much that Cuba opened their arms to Jews as it was there was a loophole in the law that allowed Jews who had established residency in the hemisphere, once they had established residency, then they could come into the United States without regard to the quota system. And Cuba, at the time, it was relatively easy to establish residency. So a lot of Jews who had been looking to come to the United States made the determination that instead they could go to Cuba, wait there effectively for a year, gain their residency, and then come the quick 90 miles to Key West from there. So it became what seemed like a logical jumping off point. Until the U.S. United States government closed that loophole, and all of these tens of thousands of Jews that had come to Cuba really only as a stepping stone to the United States found that they were stranded there. They were refugees or refugee camps built along the harbor. At that point, they needed to find a way out.
And there's such a fascinating history, too, about how then smugglers started to, you know, we see it today when people smuggling humans into the U.S. It was going on as they were trying to smuggle Jews from Cuba into Key West. Real quickly to finish up here, what conversations have you had with Jewish leaders in Key West about the book and the legacy of Jews on the island?
I have a lot of conversations. I think people are grateful that this history is visible. It had disappeared. You know, not only was it not a part of the real written legacy of Key West, but it had disappeared from local oral history to a large degree because the community was so splintered by the anti-immigration, you know, hysteria of the 1920s and 1930s. I think a lot of stories about what was, you know, illegal or undesirable behavior were not told very often in families. And so they had, you know, they had remained quiet. So it's something that's new for people within the community. And you know, there's a lot of gratitude that it's out there.
I have 40 plus years living in Florida, so much I didn't know, and really fascinating. Living in South Florida, by the way. Let me get you, before we leave, let me get you to answer the trivia question, which was likely the first Jewish-owned bar in Key West?
Gosh, when you asked that trivia question, I wasn't sure I could remember it. But I think, was it The Last Chance Saloon?
The Last Chance Saloon on Front Street,
good.
Yeah.
I'm glad I didn't blow my own trivia question.
Arlo Haskell, again, his book is The Jews of Key West, Smugglers, Cigar Makers, and Revolutionaries, the February title for the Sundial Book Club. Learn more about it on our Facebook page. Ask to join. It's free. We'd love to have you. It is a fascinating book. Again, history that, for so many of us who've lived here in South Florida, we do. I think, as you said, Arlo, you think of Key West a certain way. There's a history that really this book opened up. It is really, really fascinating. I really appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Hey, thanks so much, Louis. Really appreciate you getting the word out to your audience.
Fantastic. And again, find us on Facebook, our Sundial Book Club. Ask to join. Check out the book. Let us know what you think as you've been reading it. All right, still to come, a new play in Boca Raton explores the issues of Me Too and the Jewish faith. It's coming up next on Sundial. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. The new play, Mikvah, addresses the women's movement and mental illness by offering a glimpse inside the Jewish religious space and ritual bath. It centers around seven women who become close while inside the sacred waters of the bath. Now, it reveals each of the women's lives in the outside world, each struggling to find their place in a religious society. And some choose to defend their equal rights while others stay quiet. Sherry Upman is the director of Hadar Galran's powerful play. It will have two performances at the Anaitora Congregation in Boca Raton, February 20th, one at 2 o'clock, one at 7:30. You can find ticket information on Facebook and Twitter, WLRN Sundial. And Sherry Upman joins us now. Welcome to the program.
Oh, thank you so much for having me on.
Oh, such a pleasure. I was trying to describe the story. I'm not going to do as good a job as you are. How do you describe this story, the heart of this play, to the audience?
Well, the play takes place in Israel now. It was written in 2004, but it is very current. We are absolutely current with the play. It could be yesterday. And the ritual bath, which is the English word for mikvah, in an Orthodox Jewish community, this takes place in Israel. Where very common, where women make monthly visits to cleanse and purify themselves. Now, you, I know you know a lot about South Florida, but there are several mikvahs for women and for men in South Florida. One of the fascinating things about mikvahs is that they're not, you can't just pass it on the road and you say, oh, there's the mikvah. You have to know where it is.
Right.
It's usually behind something. And there's a sense of privacy. But it is a very important place for women to go every month. I went, my daughter went, some women choose not to go. It is a very beautiful experience. But this play, written by Hadar Galran, which came to me via Israel, that I just mentioned that I had the play in my drawer for, oh, maybe about 5 years. And one day I said, wait a minute, I'd like to take a look at that play. B'nai Torah always asked me to be part of their theatrical cultural series. And I read it. It's a long play. And the women were so fascinating and so real.
And real briefly, tell me a little bit about the women who take part in this, because my understanding is you have women who are holding on to an older way of thinking, and then you have a woman who's really a little bit more modern and kind of breaking out of that.
Exactly. Sounds like you saw the play. That's exactly what it's about, because there's Shoshana, who is an older woman. She's very well established. She's called the senior bath attendant. And she's been working in the mikvah for, I don't know, maybe 10 or 15 years. She knows everybody in the community. She knows all the women, and she knows everybody's business. And then there's Shira, who is the new younger bath attendant. Her assistant comes in, and Shira is the one who sees that one of the women is being abused. There's abuse marks all over her body. And Shoshana has decided not to say anything about it. Don't ask, don't tell. This is your business. We don't want to bring any other outside mysteries into the mikvah. And Shira says, well, no, you have to. You have to give her a card where to go for domestic abuse. And that is one of the hearts of the play, where it's the old world, the old guard. What would we say? Don't ask, don't tell.
Right.
And Shira, who says, no, you must say something. And the play unfolds with other characters having problems and differences, major problems that come into the mikvah. So how do they handle it?
And as you alluded to, I mean, you're approaching this play approaches issues like sexual abuse, suicide,
yes.
mental illness.
Yes.
How does putting on a show like this help get the conversation going within the Jewish community on these issues?
Well, the conversation, which I hope doesn't start in the middle of the play, it touches on what is happening right now. Look, the Me Too movement, which is not really new. I mean, women for centuries have known what is right and what is wrong. It's just coming out now, and it's so wonderful and, you know, very refreshing. Now, that's a very interesting question, because I can't separate it fully as far as the Jewish Me Too or the Catholic Me Too. I think we're crossing lines. As far as being religious is concerned, in this particular community, remember, they're ultra-Orthodox. And there are different sects of the Jewish religion. There's the ultra-Orthodox that tolerate nothing.
Right.
We even have on stage the code of Jewish law that you can look up, and there's an answer for everything. So it's a patriotic community where you respect your husband, the husband studies while the woman works, and marriage is absolutely essential, which leads to an... Yes, go on.
No, it's a fascinating look at two worlds, a modern and a more traditional world, in that conflict in trying to talk about issues where older generations may say, we're just not going to talk about it, where the new generation wants to talk about it. I did say that right. I hope I did. It is Gadar Galron. Is that right?
Yes.
Thank you. Okay. I want to make sure I get that right. So we're talking with Sherry Uppin, and she's the director of the Gadar Galron's powerful play, Mikvah.
Her first name, I want to make sure that we're both saying it right, is Hadar.
Hadar.
It's H-A-D-A-R, yes.
Hadar Galron. Okay, perfect.
Galron. And I say that because I have spoken to her on the phone several times.
Oh.
She actually called me and congratulated me on directing and putting on the play.
Well, did you get to ask her about, like, what, you know, what her intention is? Because every director takes a show and kind of makes it their own, but you got to talk to her.
I did. And she said to me, I'm very glad that you are directing the show. And I just took that as a compliment. And I said, thank you. And I've been thinking about it, because what she has done, which I absolutely adore and respect her for, is she has given me a director's right of putting it on through my eyes. There's nothing in the script that says you must do this, you must do that. And so what I have done is I have added music. I have a flute player and a violin player, which I thought would add to, I like to underscore my plays and make it interesting. There's a little girl who is mute. Her mother is the one who's abused. And the father has said to the little girl, if you ever say anything, I'm going to kill you. So the little girl has decided to be an elective mute. Now,
wow.
That I thought was interesting, because my background is a lot in musical theater.
Yeah.
So what I did was I took the liberty of having the little girl, who has a beautiful, beautiful voice, her name is Kai Koran, be the voice of the mikvah, the mute, mind you. And I've done this in an avant-garde way,
yeah.
With the flautist on stage, and she is singing a Hebrew song.
Wow.
Which is Ocean of Tears. So I'm
yeah.
making it extremely creative.
Let me just finish up real quickly in 30 seconds. Tell me, for people, what do you, because there's two performances, at least for now, but what do you want people to take away from this?
I want them to open their eyes to the fact that you do not have to stand abuse. A man cannot abuse a woman, beat her, get away with it. You need to help yourself, even if you have to run. I want people to take away the fact that another young girl comes in and she shows sign of depression and very sad, and her personality changes back and forth because she needs to be married to someone she doesn't, in an arranged marriage, that you can interject and say something.
All right, real quickly, two performances. Tell people where. It's two performances coming up in Boca Raton.
Yes, it's at B'nai Torah Congregation on Southwest 18th Street in Boca. Do you want the number for tickets?
We can put that up on our Facebook. There are two performances, 2 p.m. and one at 7:30 p.m. We'll make sure to put up the ticket information on our Facebook and Twitter at WLRN Sundial. Sherry Uppin, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for doing this.
Thanks a lot, and I hope to see you at the theater.
All right, break a leg.
Okay, thanks.
All right, we'll get that information up on our Facebook so you'll know more about it. Again, the show is called Mikvah. That's our program for this Tuesday, February 19th. I'm Luis Hernandez. Have a great day. We'll talk to you tomorrow.